Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by RacePlace.com, RunCatalina.com. You can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville on iTunes and Course Sports, the very best in women's athletic wear. Our next guest, Mr. Ryan Bolton, has gone from an Olympic triathlete back in 2000, the first year of the Olympics, to coaching the Boston Marathon champion. That's quite a transition. Ryan, how the heck are you?
I'm good. Feels like coming back home, being on the show again. It's been a while, Bob.
Well, you know what's funny is my wife was like, wait, wasn't that one of the guys in the cowboy gear on the cover of Competitor? I'm like, yeah, we did the Young Guns with Ryan and Eric, you know, those, and Darren, I think.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Let's just hope those photos don't resurface.
Oh, they are, man. I'm hunting. I'm going to find those puppies. Those are good. Those are really good. So before we get into Boston, let's talk about you growing up, right? Rapid City, South Dakota.
And yeah, that's where I was born. Yeah. I actually grew up about 140 miles away from Rapid, across the border in a little town called Gillette, Wyoming.
Gillette, Wyoming.
And oil and gas country, yeah.
And what were your sports?
Swimming, biking, and running.
Okay, so basically...
Yeah, you know, I grew up... It's a funny, because it's a small community, about 15,000 people, but we had a lot of... The county was very, very wealthy from having, all the oil and gas revenues and coal. And so, you know, unbeknownst to me, I mean, I grew up in this little small town, but we had a 50-meter indoor pool.
Wow.
You know, like I said, this is kind of Podunk, Wyoming. So I actually had, you know, and then I had roads and trails, you know, as far as the eye can see, of course. So it was actually, aside from really, really unpleasant weather in the winter, it was pretty darn good training, yeah.
And did you compete at a varsity level in high school in both running and swimming?
I did, yeah. Yeah, you know, I swam throughout my high school career until my senior year. And it was because at that point, I was a better runner. You know, I was a national class runner, and I was like a state class swimmer, I guess you could say. And also, you know, I kind of knew the lifestyle, and this is kind of like for selfish reasons. I knew the lifestyles of swimmers in college, and I didn't want to be that guy who was falling asleep in class every day, so I thought, you know what, I think I'm going to do a running scholarship instead. So my senior year, instead, I ran indoor track just to kind of bump my times up and, you know, run a little bit faster so I could get better scholarships, yeah.
And that was University of Wyoming's where you ended up going?
That's right, yeah, yeah. I kind of want to stay in the Mountain West, and being in-state in Wyoming, it was by far the best situation. They offered me by far the best economic situation scholarship, so, yeah.
And when did triathlon enter into your life?
You know, when I was probably, I want to say around 12 years of age, there was about 60 miles away, there was this little, you know, kind of rinky-dink podunk triathlon. And since I did all three sports at that age, I think for about three summers in a row, I actually did that race. And I did really well. I think, you know, like when I was 13, I was like second overall or something. And I think, you know, by the time I was 14, I think I won the whole thing. And then early on, and right the summer before I went to college, I did a triathlon just kind of for kicks, and I won that one overall too. But at that point, you know, I kind of identified as being a runner and all that stuff. And, you know, triathlon was kind of, you know, this fun, novel thing. And,
exactly.
You know, I mean, and this was, you know, that first one, you know, when I was 12, I mean, that was, you know, kind of the mid-80s, and really triathlons
were just getting very going.
Big. It was mostly just these wacky guys in San Diego, you know.
People in Speedos running around in the sun. That's basically
a bunch
of idiots.
Yeah, exactly.
Banana hammocks everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, but in college, you run, what, 14-14?
That's right, yeah. You know, I had a decent college career. Cross-country was really my sport, and a lot of that had to do with, well, you know, that's what I loved, but also training in Wyoming, in Laramie, Wyoming, you know, we're at over 7,000 feet in elevation. And, you know, from June to October, like, there's not much of a better place to be as far as training goes. I mean, there's, you know, there were dirt trails everywhere, and you could be on flats, you can be on hills, and, you know, you're at high elevation, and the temperature was just, like, perfect. But, so I would always come into cross-country season, you know, pretty darn fit. and be able to run through cross-country season well. And that's where I was an All-American in cross-country.
Yeah.
And, you know, in track, we were always hampered by, you know, weather and everything.
Sure.
And as I was running better and better, but I still, you know, indoors I ran an 808 and a 3K, which for me was good.
Yeah.
You know, these days that's like really nothing. And, yeah, and outdoors I ran 14-14. And, you know, it's funny, I have a friend who's a coach, NCAA coach, and I talked to him yesterday, and he's at the Drake Relays, which is where I ran that race. And I was like, I remember my PR. I was like, what's the weather doing there right now? He's like, yeah, it's spitting rain and stuff. And I said, yeah, I remember running my PR in, like, slush on the track. So
yeah.
I'm pretty proud of that. Yeah. Yeah. But that kind of shows maybe I was a cross-country runner, too. I was excelling in, like, adverse conditions.
Now, was your thought to potentially, you know, go to World Cross and that type of thing out of college? There weren't a heck of a lot of options for, you know, you have that cocoon of support while you're in college as a runner. But as soon as college ends, unless all of a sudden you fall into a scholarship because you're a great marathon, scholarship, a sponsorship because you're a great marathoner, there's really not much.
No, there's not. You know, and so my freshman and sophomore year of college, my good friends lived in Boulder those summers, and they actually went to school there. So I kind of ran with the guys who ran at CU a lot, and my best friend ran for CU. And, you know, post-freshman year of college, I lived in Boulder. I worked, just kind of coincidentally, as a lifeguard, I worked at Scott Carpenter Pool, which is kind of like the Digme Beach of Boulder,
right.
You know?
Yes. Yeah,
and,
yeah. It's where all everybody trains, yeah.
And I would always swim at lunch, and a pro triathlete, he was like, you know, kind of like a second or third level pro triathlete, said, you know, you're a really good swimmer, and you look like a runner, you know? He's like, have you ever done triathlon? I was like, yeah, sure, you know, I've done a couple of those. And he said, you should see how good you can do in one, you know? And I was like, all right, which one should I do? And he said, do national championships. And I was like, okay. So that summer I went and did nationals.
So without a pre-race, you just went to the nationals?
Yeah. So I went to nationals, and I won. And I won the junior race. And, and you know, the USA Triathlon people came up to me after that, and they're like, you know, who are you? And I'm like, I'm a runner, you know?
I'm a runner kid. I'm not shaving my legs. What the heck?
No,
what do you
exactly.
Want?
Yeah, exactly. Like, forget about that. And they said, well, next year, you know, you should see what you can do, because I was going to be a junior again the next year. So, you know, I went back to college. I ran that year out, which was great, but I redshirted the next outdoor track season. So this was my sophomore year. So this was like 1993-ish. And I redshirted outdoor track so that I could get on my bike, even though getting on your bike in Laramie, Wyoming in April really isn't
not
a great
very
idea.
Safe,
but,
right, yeah.
Yeah, right. But anyway, that summer, kind of long story short, I went to Boulder again. I worked at Scott Carpenter Pool again, and I kind of trained my butt off. I qualified for the junior team, and then that year I went to World Championships in triathlon, and I got second place in Manchester behind this guy from Switzerland. But the guys behind me, you know, it was a pretty stacked field. It was funny because I was talking with some pro triathletes about a year ago about the field. But like McCormick was fourth that year.
Wow.
Alexander Manzon was third. I was second, and I know I had the fastest run split. I remember that, and you know, it was like, for me, I was like, this is awesome, and I was like, okay, this is a sport, you know, that I think I can excel at. I knew I wasn't running at that level, you know. It wasn't like I could have went to World Cross Country as a junior, and got second, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And I went back to college, and my coaches were like, hey, that's really, really great. But
forget about it.
We're paying you money to run, and you need to make a decision on what you're going to do. You know, and I mean, I was 19 years old, and I could have started racing, I guess, triathlon. But at that point, I said, you know what? The next 3 years, I'm not swimming. I'm not biking. I'm kind of going to dedicate my time to becoming the best runner I can be. And, you know, because, I mean, and also this is how they're paying for my college education. And so that's what I decided to do. And so, you know, I just ran my next 3 years out, which ended up paying off because I ended up becoming, you know, a much better runner and, you know, at that point. But kind of to get back to what you were saying, but, you know, by the time I got to be a senior, I was running at a national class level. Like, I think, you know, at cross-country nationals that year, like, I was, you know, one of the, like, top Americans in the race, you know, being 12th overall, you know.
Wow.
I probably could have ran, you know, as an elite or professionally. But, you know, I mean, probably two events happened during that period. Event number one is me looking in the mirror and saying, okay, you weigh 150 pounds.
Kenyans weigh 110.
Right, yes, exactly. Yeah.
And they're 5 foot two.
Photos of me in track and field news, like running with, you know, the lead group at NCAAs, and, you know, I'm like, you
Arnold
know, I'm
Schwarzenegger
the biggest
guy.
Dude
yeah,
there,
yeah.
Right, you know, I've got muscles.
Yes.
And I was like, you know, that's one. I was like, you know, you're not built, like, to be a world-class runner. You know, you love this sport, and this is what you're doing. And I was like, but, you know, I did look in the mirror, and I was like, I could be, you know, a great triathlete. And then at that same time, it was 96.
So they announced
that,
the Olympics.
You know, triathlon, exactly. So
yeah.
I was kind of like, this is it. This is my ticket.
This is
the goal.
Perfect storm, right? You're ready to do something.
Yeah.
You're going to go pro in something, and all of a sudden you find that the Olympics are going to be, triathlon's going to be
the
Olympics.
Yeah.
So do you think if triathlon hadn't been in the Olympics, would you have chased the road scene for a while?
You know, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard to say. But, you know, I ultimately in triathlon, I ended up really liking the Ironman and the Ironman distance more than the Olympic distance and the whole Olympic, you know, scene and all that stuff.
Right.
And so I think I still maybe would have became a triathlete. I just think maybe I would have, like, you know, migrated toward the Ironman, like,
sure,
earlier than ultimately I did. So, yeah.
So when you realize you're going to be in the sport's going to be in the Olympics, did you become part of that training group that trained at the Olympic Training Center, or were you off with your own, training by yourself or training with a group?
Well, I trained, you know, for those first years, the first year I moved to San Diego, and it was because Dan Ampfield called me.
Yes.
In very Dan Ampfield style, and he was like, "Hey Ryan, my name is Dan Ampfield," and you know, that was when he owned QR.
And
he said, "You know, come out to San." He's like, "I called USA Triathlon today, and I asked him who's going to be on the Olympic team, and they gave me your name, and I didn't know who the heck you were, and you know, I looked you up, and okay, and so he actually, I came out and lived with Ampfield, you know, and he kind of got me up and going in San Diego, which was
really
fantastic,
cool.
I mean, I'm grateful, you know, to him to this day, but." All of my friends still lived in Boulder, and, you know, Boulder was, as it is now, you know, training hotbed. So in, you know, the next year, ultimately, in 98, you know, I moved there. And I also started working with Joe Friel.
Right.
That year, who was my coach throughout my career, who I still, you know, I'm in contact with, and I still,
you were,
like,
yeah,
really respect
training
and everything.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
So at that point, they really didn't have they didn't have the triathletes training at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, or...
Well, they were just getting that going,
okay.
And so that's what, in 99, I was, you know, one of the top-ranked Americans, I was racing the World Cup circuit, and, you know, I had the option of going down there, and I really did, I wanted to be swimming with a good group, I wanted to be around, like, basically draft-legal type athletes, and
yeah.
So in, like, October of 99, I still had my place in Boulder, but I also, you know, I had a dorm room and spent 90% of my time in Colorado Springs until I made the Olympic team and actually through the Olympic Games, basically. And then I moved back to Boulder almost immediately after that. So I ended up spending a full 10 months at the OTC, which was a great experience, yeah.
Well, and really, like in 96, 97, when you were doing some of those age group races or the world championships, were they draft legal or were they still non-drafting?
They were draft legal.
Okay.
Yep, that was basically...
That was a kickoff.
You know, the switchover, exactly.
Yeah.
It was almost when that switch, you know, I got in on that switch, which was, it was an interesting time because, you know, there were some older guys, and I mean, they weren't old at the time, that were, you know, the really great guys who were, you know, they were used to the old school
sure.
system. Like, two guys who I really think about are Jimmy Riccitiello
yep.
and Wes Hobson.
Yes.
And those guys are both really, really great guys, if you know either of them, which I know you probably do.
Yes.
But, you know, I remember being at World Championships, and I want to say it was 98 or so in Switzerland. And they were both, you know, they were both very realistic about what draft legal racing was. And they came kind of from the old school non-drafting, and also non-drafting really benefited those guys. But they were ahead of their time, because I remember having a team meeting ahead of the race, you know, and they were both like, "Listen, we're good cyclists, and we're willing to work here because we know that it's gonna, you know, it's gonna be team tactics, and it's ultimately gonna come down to that." And yeah, you know, I think you're seeing that even
that's
you know, more today, but, yeah.
that's pretty selfless on their part to realize
no,
that
it
you
was.
Know what,
yeah, it was.
We're better cyclists than you guys, and we can pull you, but
right,
and
exactly.
we can't run with you. We know we can't
right,
run
exactly.
With you.
Yeah, yeah, And I mean, and those guys were, I mean, I, you know, like I said, both of them were racing some World Cup races, and you know, and both of them really had that, you know, mentality of, yes, of helping and everything, you know. And it was kind of like I said, it was a changing of the guard, because then, you know, the other half of the team was like, you know, I realize that, you know, that this is draft legal, but, you know, I'm fending for myself, you know.
Exactly.
You know, and yeah.
Right. So, and really for the trials that year, I mean, it came down to the race in Sydney where people could get a spot, and then the race in Dallas.
That was
it, right? And you knew all the, basically, everything's on the line in that particular race. If you don't, if you don't finish, what you'd
you had to be top. Yeah, exactly. And I actually did not go to the Sydney race because I was pretty confident in my chances of making the team, because I'd been training with most of the guys that were training, you know, to make the team, and I knew that I was in good shape. I had a good early season. I won St. Anthony's. I was running well. I ran under 31 minutes off the bike, which in those days was fast, and now that's like, you know, kind of pedestrian.
To show you how it's changed, Mac a couple years ago decided he was going to jump back into the World Cup scene. And I was here in San Diego. The guy ran 31:30 off the bike. And, you know, back in those days, those courses, who knew how, you know, who was measuring those things? They're pretty measured now. He ran 31:30 and was 50th.
Right, exactly.
Dude. Yeah, exactly. And he was off the bike with everybody. You're just going, oh, my God. It is a different world.
It's like eye-opener, you know. Yeah, but I watch those races now, and I'm just blown away. Those guys are so aggressive in all three sports.
It is amazing. So,
but anyway, so I went to Dallas, and I had an atrocious race. Like, I had this just absolutely horrible swim. I got off, and, you know, we got in tax on the bike, and no one was working on the bike, and you know, I had to, like, corral people to work on the bike, and I think I ended up getting off the bike. And it was the second pack, but it was a pretty big pack. And, you know, we were multiple minutes down, you know, two or three minutes down on the front pack, and I just had to run like a maniac to get the spot. But, I mean, you know, obviously I got the spot, unfortunately. But I had to pinpoint one of the worst races of my career. It was the Olympic trials, which I guess, ironically, I made the team there, but, man, it was a bad race.
Well, and sometimes you look at it, and making the team is sometimes more exciting than, I mean, the Olympics are wonderful, but just knowing, coming down that final stretch and knowing that you're gonna go to the first ever Olympic triathlon, that had a pretty special feeling.
No, for sure. Yeah, it is. I mean, for me, like I said, it was far from one of the best races of my triathlon career, but it was probably one of the greatest moments of it.
Of course.
Sense, you know? Yeah.
And I always try to tell people, the thing about the first ever Olympic triathlon is, I think the women's race was the first event of the games, and you guys were, what, the second day or something?
Yeah, we were
like
day
that.
Two. Yeah,
day
yeah,
two.
Exactly.
So they were using the triathlon as a travelogue to showcase the city of Sydney, the Sydney Opera House, and the bridge, and the crowds were, I remember McKeely telling me, the crowds were so loud that she couldn't hear herself, right? It was
it was insane. And the course was, you know, it was all around the botanical gardens, you know, the transition area was the opera house. I mean, it did profile the sport. And I also think Australia did that on purpose as well, because they had, as they still do, like, you know, their athletes were some of the top people in the race, and they were expecting really great results.
They were supposed to sweep.
You know, what a way to start the Olympics,
you know? Yeah. They were supposed to sweep on the men's side, right?
Right, exactly. And it was kind of, it was a disaster on the men's side. So,
So you end up, what, 25th or something, your Olympic experience. And because your event was so early, I'm sure you couldn't walk in the opening ceremonies. So did you stay around for the closing ceremonies? That's a couple weeks. What did you end up?
Yeah, I did.
You get up? Yeah.
You know, it's funny because, like, and I mean, you know, I'm not a big party guy.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the coolest thing about the Olympics.
Absolutely.
We were done on day two. And so you can, with your credentials, for one, and being, you know, American credentials, like almost everywhere in Sydney, you have these credentials. And on the back, you know, there were restaurants, bars, et cetera, that you could go to. And you could walk in and show the credential, and they would just start hooking you up, you know. So it was kind of like this smorgasbord of craziness, you know.
But in addition to that,
you know, I mean, you know, all the stories are kind of true. Like, the Olympic Village every night, like, went off, you know, on its own. Like, if I were an athlete that were racing, and our, you know, our federation, and on purpose, we did not move into the Olympic Village until after we raced, which was
smart
really smart move.
Yeah.
But, But the other really cool thing on the less party side of things was you could get tickets to almost anything. So I went to track and field every day, you know,
wow.
And the seats were, you know, fantastic. So, you know, I would get, you know, you'd go and get tickets for, you know, the things that you wanted. But, you know, I was able to watch, you know, every distance event and all that stuff. And, I mean, it was, like, for me, it was a dream because I got to watch the 10K, which that's one of the most magical, like, Olympic 10Ks of all time, Paul Tergat versus Haile Gebrselassie, and it was just a major battle. And I mean, so that part was super cool, too. Yeah, and then I stayed through the closing ceremonies, which was a crazy party in itself, and, yeah, and then, you know, came back.
What I love is a lot of times people go from the Olympic distance, Olympic format, and have a tough transition to longer distance. But
yeah.
We're looking at, for you, it seemed like it was pretty quick. Your first Ironman, what'd you get, second or third? And then then you won Ironman Lake Placid in 2002 and took 2001, right? You went to Kona?
2002. So, yeah, 2001, I, you know, after the Olympic year, I sat down with my coach and you know, he knew me, he knew my physiology,
yeah.
And he sat down and, you know, we said, you know, what's next? You know, am I going to start chasing points for Athens in 2004 or, you know, do I want to do Ironman? And I said, I really feel like I'm an Ironman athlete. I was like, this Olympic distance stuff is great, but it's more of a, you know, it's a bike racing type situation. And there's 10 guys that can start the Olympic race with the potential to win. And he's like, you know, it just, stuff has to go right for you to win on that day.
Yes,
you know?
That's true.
And I really feel like, and I feel like that's true. And with Ironman, I really feel like usually the best athlete wins.
No
I mean,
question.
Things happen
Unless
at that race,
happens.
But
yeah,
exactly. And I liked that. Like I said,
it's pretty
you know,
pure.
I like that. Right, exactly.
Yeah,
so,
that's old style triathlon. It's like the best guy and best gal, unless something happens mechanical or someone has a unbelievable race.
Yeah.
Like, look at your debut in 2001. What, Steve Larson has the, you know, the greatest race of his life. Right,
right. He
ran 2:55
exactly, yeah.
off the bike without. I think he ran 9 miles a week leading into
no,
that
exactly.
race.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it was insane. Yeah, and you know it was that, and that was my first race. You know,
right.
it was my. You know, I did St. Croix that year, and I won St. Croix, and that was my second half of my career.
Right.
But it was my first half, like real half, that I did, and you know, and that was a great win. And I was like, okay, you know, this long distance stuff might be suited for me, and then I did Lake Placid that year, and I got second to Steve Larson,
yeah.
who blitzed. I mean, he blitzed the bike. And then he ran a three. I mean, I think I ran like 2:50 there
yes.
that year or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not a fast course. I mean, it's not a super slow course on the run either. But, like, Larson ran like 2:59 or something.
I know. And
which,
it was
like,
his
for
first
a dude
marathon.
Who wasn't running, yeah, I was like, okay, you know, I'll get it to him. You know, wow, that's
You just
a
tip
good
your
race.
Hat on it, something like that. But then the following year, you run 2:49, and I think you had the fastest bike and the fastest run, 8:39.
Yeah, I did, yeah. And that's, you know, that's probably the first year that my bike really started coming around. And I, just because, you know, I was coming from the Olympic distance stuff,
yes.
I was finally starting to get that strength on the bike and kind of learning how to push, you know, power in the gears. And those were actually the early days of, you know, power meters, and Joe Friel was kind of on top of that. So, you know, I was riding a power tap wheel during
yep.
that time, which I still have my first power tap because it's kind of a dinosaur.
It is a dinosaur.
And I figured
yeah.
I'll put it on the wall and frame it. But yeah, so you know, my numbers were kind of starting to come around on the bike, and I was starting to feel, you know, more like an Ironman dude. But I knew it was going to take some time to get there. But
And in 2001, you went to Kona, and
right.
now where was you have a 13-minute T2? What the hell?
Yeah, that was. I think it was in 2003 that I had.
Oh, was it?
Okay,
T2. Okay.
Yeah, and Kona is Kona.
Right.
And I mean, if there's one thing that I regret about not racing longer than I raced was not going to that race one time at least,
yeah.
and like and
Best
hitting
shape.
It there. You
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
And that year, 2001 was my first year there. I learned a lot. That's what happens in Kona.
Yeah. yeah.
2002, I got a really bad. Bacterial infection 2 weeks prior to the race.
I remember that because we were talking
yeah.
about you as being potentially being a factor that year, yeah.
Right, yeah, because I was really, really fit. And
yep.
I mean, it's kind of a long story, but yeah, I ended up getting into, like, it was like food poisoning, basically.
And you were coming off of winning Lake Placid with a 2:49, so we were all
yeah,
like, ooh,
exactly.
8:39,
yeah.
I think this guy's going to be something.
Yep. But in 2003, what happened is I got to mile 80 on the bike or so. And I was, you know, I was having a decent day, you know, not a brilliant day, but certainly better than in my debut race. And And I wasn't peeing. I was getting really, really bloated. And I could barely get in aero position any longer. And I came into the med tent and, you know, they like, you know, hey, are you okay? And I was like, well, you know, I'm okay.
I'm still alive.
I was like, I haven't peed. I can barely like bend over because I'm really, really bloated. And, you know, and they sat me down with the doctor and I was actually hypernatremic. I was taking salt tabs and I was retaining water and I wasn't. And he said, just sit here, you know, drink water. I think you're hypernatremic. And I sat there and drank water for about 10 minutes, and then I, like, peed, and then it was like, oh, yes, okay, this feels good, you know, and I ran out of transition. And the first 10K, I was like, really just kind of, you know, jogging along, but, you know, I kind of got into my rhythm, and I actually ended up running a decent marathon that
day. Yeah, 250. You ran a 250 and finished 28th, which I'm imagining you were back in, like, 8,000th by the time you started running.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is, I think it's one of the, at least in my Ironman career, it was one of the only times that, I mean, I'm almost certain that I negative splitted that race. So on the run, usually doesn't happen. And, you know, in the energy lab, I was feeling like $1 million, which not many people can say that.
No, ever. So you go from having some good Ironman and good transition from short course to long course. When did the run coaching enter into it? Usually guys sort of taper out their career, get into coaching some triathletes, and that's it. But usually people don't look at triathletes as someone to coach an elite runner.
Right, yeah. Well, in 04, I was enjoying triathlon. You know, I had great contracts and great sponsors and, you know, and I was going through the motions, but it kind of got to that point where I was like, you know, I was only, you know, I was like 31, 32 years of age, and I was like, I'm just going through the motions at this point. And I was like, this is the type of career, you know, that you need to be in it 100%. And I was going through the motions, you know. Right. I was training great. My fitness was good, but the fire wasn't there. The passion wasn't there, and I sat down with, you know, Joe Friel, you know, and he said, maybe you should take a break. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, I think I should take a break, but I think it might be for a forever break. And he said, whatever, that's fine. And I know, you know, some people were disappointed. Oh, you know, you never, you know, race to your potential, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, when I look back on it, it was a good decision. But I also, what I did that year was the day after I had that conversation with Joe, you know, and this was like early in 2004, maybe April. I called my graduate professors from graduate school, like where I went to undergrad.
Yeah.
And I actually did a year of graduate school. And I said, I told you that when I left back in 96, that I was going to come back when I'm done with my triathlon career. I'm done. I want to start grad school again. So by that fall, I was actually re-enrolled in graduate school, and I ended up getting, you know, I was there for 2 years and ended up getting my degree in, it's in human nutrition, but we did metabolism studies and basically exercise science type stuff, which is what my undergrad was in too. So coming out of that, I kind of had the logical background for coaching. At the time, I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't thinking, hey, you know, your career is going to be as a coach and you're going to coach triathletes and these elite runners. But it just kind of fell into place, and you know, and Joe Friel also at the time was saying, you know, you should come work with me, and you know, you should take on some athletes. And I had just, you know, doors opened up here and there, and it ended up kind of all falling into place where I ended up coaching. I mean, because I do right now continue to coach, you know, triathletes from everywhere, from around the world. But I also, you know, ended up coaching a small group of, you know, some of the best runners in the world, too, that hands-on, you know, that are, like, you know, in a camp with me in Santa Fe.
Well, and so when did you move to Santa Fe?
So I moved to Santa Fe in 2008. So I had 2 years post-grad school where I stayed in Wyoming, and I was starting to coach, and I was working for this nonprofit organization and kind of enjoying that and everything. But it became pretty apparent that, like, you know, I wanted to be coaching full time, and I moved to Santa Fe in mid 2008. And there was a group. There's actually a lot of groups in the Albuquerque Santa Fe area of elite runners, but I had a friend who was helping out with this group of athletes here, and he said, and he introduced me to their manager at the time, and said, you know, hey, you know, can you help with these guys? And the manager, he didn't know much about running, and it was kind of an interesting situation. But he had, you know, he had a handful of these, you know, pretty darn good East African runners, and he said, hey, you know, will you help with this? And, you know, can you kind of like partially coach these guys? And I said
partially.
Yeah, exactly. Key. That's
sort of
a key word, right?
You
want to
partially date for a while?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
No.
Yeah. Either you're dating or you're not dating.
I kind of was like, hey, and I mean, this should have been actually warning sign number one with this agent, but I said, yeah, you can't partially coach someone.
No.
I was like, it's either 100% or nothing, you know?
Exactly.
And I said, so, you know, I said, I'm busy, but, you know, I can definitely do this, and, you know, I'm really interested in doing this, because I was really interested in, you know, seeing what can happen. And so I joined this group, and for the next, basically, year and a half, there were probably, I would say, 8 runners in this group, and I identified a few of them that I just connected with, and that I really kind of liked. But probably more important than that, they connected with me and they believed in me, because, like, seriously, like, some of these guys, you know, they were like, you know, they were skeptical. They're these, you know, Kenyan guys, and they're like, you know, who's this
swimmer biker guy?
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I understand it. Yeah.
Yeah, but a few in the group, you know, and really the first 2 years, I really worked with 2 of the athletes for the most part. And one of those athletes was Caroline Rokic, and the other one was Heron Lagat, which, interestingly, he's a Diamond League steeplechaser.
Okay.
Interestingly, those 2 people I actually still coach. And I kind of, both of them were willing to commit fully to me, and I also, just based on their kind of character and the talent that I saw with them, I said I can commit with them. And like I said, there were other people in the group, but like I said, they didn't want to, you know, subscribe to what I was doing, or I didn't connect with them, or I didn't, you know, whatever, feel, you know, close to them or whatever. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of that thing. And also, honestly, like, it was kind of the same thing. I'm like, I'm not taking on 10 dudes right now, you know, and trying to wrangle them.
Exactly.
So what happened is I worked with Caro, and she ended up, you know, she was a totally underdeveloped runner. You know, she had zero direction with coaching and everything. And I said, you know, I'm going to put you on a good running program, and you have to think differently. Because at the time, a lot of those guys, you know, they were just running every weekend and, you know, some local 5K for $400. And I said, we're planning out a year. We're identifying big races where you can make bigger and better money, and in that one weekend you're going to make more money than you can make all year, you know, from running these little things. But you've got to trust me, and you've got to believe in me, because they get nervous, because they're like, well, I want to have to pay rent next month. And I'm like, trust me, you're going to be able to pay rent, you know, if you just listen. And so
stay the course.
Her and Heron were kind of the 2 people that said, I'm on board. And the other ones were like, no, I want to race the Topeka 5K next week. And I said, okay, fine, I'm not working with you. But Caro, by the end of 2009, it worked out that she won the Las Vegas Marathon, and she won this equalizer bonus, which is kind of like the LA Marathon.
Yes.
She won $25,000. And at that point, she was like,
I'm in.
Okay, I'm listening to everything you say. You know? And, you know, Heron was kind of the same way. And then the next year, you know, we kept on progressing. She kept on running better, you know, and I kept on working, like, with Heron and Caro in that group. Some of the other athletes were starting to be like, hey, you know, can we maybe train with you guys? And I still, at the time, I was like, well, you know, I'm not sure. And you know, I wasn't sure if I wanted to be, like, involved with them. But I also, at that time, like, started seeing things within that group that, like, that I didn't like believe in, the way that it was being ran and the way that it was being managed, and so I kind of started getting a lot of red flags being drawn, and I started learning, you know, the dynamics of this whole world of, you know,
East
agents
Africans,
and,
and agents, so you're dealing with, and Ethiopians and Kenyans are usually not buddies. right? Yeah, there's
exactly.
a lot of those guys yeah, do yeah, not like yeah. each other, because you go into the Olympics, man, and it's all about let's team up and we're gonna.
No, exactly.
So how yeah. did you, when I hear that you've got a house in Santa Fe and you've got two Ethiopians and four Kenyans and they're hanging together,
yeah,
and I'm like,
yeah.
is he keeping the silverware away? How's he?
No, and that's exactly right. So what happened in 2010 is. Another kid came along, and you may know him. His name is Aaron Rono, and he ran for Azusa Pacific, and he was like a four-time national cross-country champion for, whatever division school that is, and
yeah.
just a really talented kid. And he joined this group, and right away he said, "I want you to be my coach." And so, like I said, later in that year, after kind of these red flags about the group were starting to come up. I basically sat down with those three athletes, with Heron Legat, Aaron Rono, and Caroline, and I said, I love working with you guys. You guys are great athletes. I can no longer be affiliated with the manager of that group. Like I would love to continue working with you guys, but if you're with him,
right.
I can't work with you. And they all said, we're with you. And I said, great. And because I knew other agents in the sport at this point and everything, and I said, it's easy to transfer you over. And so
sure.
that was the year then that I formed the Harambe Project, and I pulled those guys, and we had a house, and at that time it was, those three Kenyans, and we had a house that, I subsidized, and we bought this just, beat up, crappy minivan that, I shuttled us around
in.
And, we went to workouts and stuff, and the results kept on coming in, and we got more attention, and we started getting some neat athletes to join the group, people who I really believed in, and people who were really, like I said, people who said, no, I'm totally subscribed to your training plan, and I believe in it, and it's ebbed and flowed a little bit, just from natural, like Aaron Rono, great kid. In 2012, he ran a 27:31, I want to say 10K, which is an A standard and everything, but, it's hard conversation for me to have, because at the end of the year, he's like, I'm not making any money, I'm running the Olympic A standard, but as a Kenyan, you've got to be way better than the Olympic A standard to, be even making noise. And he ended up he married an American girl, he joined the army, so.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, 27:31 over in Kenya is like 22nd. Right?
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly, and that's true. And that was exactly
the case.
He's a 22nd
ranked Kenyan. So what's he going to do if he's in the U.S.? He's making millions.
Yeah,
of dollars.
Yeah, one of the top dudes. Exactly.
Yeah.
No, totally.
Wow.
So,
but
like Karen, for example, has a great agent, and was kind of getting established on the Diamond League circuit. Karen was really starting to rip it up on the roads, and she won New York Half a couple times, and.
Well, and she was fourth in Boston and fifth in Chicago,
exactly,
and fourth in Tokyo. So it's not like she came out of nowhere.
I mean, she was really running, well, and I was happy with that scene. And then, I started working with I have an Ethiopian girl who runs with us now. She actually, I can say, because you mentioned this, she actually lives in Albuquerque, and she lives with her husband, who is also Ethiopian, but. They get along really, really well. Like she's a great partner, with the other couple girls that I have here, Caroline being one of those, Alfie Tulumuk is like the other. Those three are kind of like all big training buddies, and they hang out. It's a small group here, that I have. But I also, to this point, it's my main job is training and coaching triathletes, that is how I make my money. The Harambe Project has always been, it's funny because I call it, sort of a hobby. It's like, it's totally my passion. It's totally what I love doing the most. And I also feel like, it's kind of, it's what I feel like really strongest as a coach, working with those guys and, laying out their plans and their programs and everything. But it is, it's kind of it's a project. I mean,
sure.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
So Harambe, that's a Kenyan term meaning together, and if you together we achieve more.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It is. And when I started, working back, with Caro in about 2009, that was a term that, you know, she would use is, you know, Kenyans, where are Kenyans good? And, Harambe, you know, they'd say, well, it's Ugali, it's their chai tea, but it's Harambe, you know, it's like what, it's us training hard and working together and basically feeding off each other to make each other better. And I thought, that's a cool name for,
absolutely,
you know, that's what we should call the group, because, I mean, it's kind of what we do, you know, it's kind of, you know, what we're trying to create here, yeah.
Now, do you bring any cross-training, any triathlon training into this, or is it pure running training?
Very little cross-training. Hmm. None of those guys can swim. like, and when I say they can't swim, I mean like
floating, not even
like
floaties,
not at all. Like throw them in, you know, in water over their head, and we're talking trouble, you know. but you know, one thing that we do that it's not conventional, especially with East Africans, is I'm in the gym with those guys twice a week. We really work on strength. I mean, kind of for two reasons. For strength, I mean, is you know, kind of reason number one, but also for injury prevention. And you know, it was funny because a really good friend of mine in Santa Fe, you know, immediately after Boston, he called me and he was like, Carol looks so powerful, you know, coming down the last 600 meters. And
she did.
I said,
actually,
she did. I was like, I was like, and that's not a coincidence. I was like, we've been working on that. We've been, you know, for the past 5 years, we've been working on getting her to the point, you know, where A, she can have that kick, and B, she can have the strength to have that kick. And, you know, it's taken some time and everything, but, you know, but it is, I mean, that's, the marathon is like an Ironman. It's like training an Ironman athlete, you know. It takes years to really develop into, you know, the person and the potential that you have to be. It's not an overnight thing.
No.
And, yeah, I mean, she's a great example of that. I mean, I think Boston was her 10th marathon, and, you know, and, you know, like I said, she was always, you know, kind of at this bridesmaid status, and, you know, I've been at so many races with her where she's there until that, you know, one critical moment. And, you know, and that's what people are, oh, this is such a surprise. I'm like, it's not a surprise.
No.
You know, she,
no.
You know, like you said, you know, she's been there. She's been almost there every year. You just really notice it when, you know, when they end up crossing the finish line first.
Well, and it's similar to ITU style racing where you've got so many top athletes that are all coming through at the same time. Because I look at this, you have 14 seconds separating first, second, and third for the women. It's 4 seconds that, you know, marathons never used to come down to a sprint. You know,
right,
Caroline
yeah.
has to you know, out-sprint Mari Dibaba to get,
right,
you know,
yeah,
to get the,
yeah,
get the win. So
yeah,
where
well,
were
in training, I mean, and in training, we specifically train for those types of conditions. You know, I mean, the way it's aggressive racing anymore. And,
yes,
you know, it's, and like I said, we, you know, Boston is a racer's race. So you have to be ready for multiple different scenarios in the race. But most importantly, you need to be ready for massive accelerations, very aggressive accelerations, and a strong finish like that, you know. And you got to be physically ready, and you also have to be mentally ready, because you've got to know and you've got to believe that you're going to win that race. Because when it comes down to, like, how tight those goals were at the end, it came down to who thought that they were the toughest, you know, biggest,
yes,
badass.
No question. No question.
Yeah,
when you're coming down Boylston together, when you're coming down Boylston side by side, it's really who's, you know, that's where that strength training, that's where that 5 years of being in the gym makes the difference that you don't think about. And the fact that you do that type of acceleration, because a lot of times it's sort of steady state. But
right, exactly, yeah.
Being able to,
you know,
sprint,
we work
at
on
the
both
end,
with training, of course. You know, we do a lot of pure tempo running where, you know, we're just going out and, you know, doing pure tempo pace, you know, race pace type stuff. But I also, we do the type of training where, you know, we're doing off tempo to, you know, 105% race pace, and then off tempo to 105% race pace, because, you know, that is how it happens. So your body has to be used to that. And it's, you have to train that. Yeah, I mean, obviously some athletes are, you know, more adept to it than others, but I mean, but you have to train to be that way, and you have to have both of those tricks in your back pocket. You have to be able to go with that really high tempo for a long time, but you know, Boston this year, I knew, and we had a very specific game plan going into the race, especially, you know, when they announced kind of what the weather conditions were going to be like and everything, and just kind of based on who was in the race,
yeah,
in the field, I kind of had a feeling, you know, it was probably going to play out the way that it played out, and that's how we planned for it to play out. So, you know, the game plan was, like, you know, tuck in, conserve energy. You know,
stay
it's
out of the
long
wind. Let somebody race. Else pull you. It's like ITU racing all over again. Stay in the draft.
No, exactly. Yes, I mean it's cycling tactics, and I mean in fact, like I think the terminology that I used with her is I said, "Do not let your nose hit the wind."
Yes.
You know, until at least the 25-kilometer mark. You know, and I said, and the only reason it should hit the wind is if you're covering a move that has to be covered. And she's, you know, I said, you know, you're an athlete, you're an artist. You know what's a real move. I mean, it's just like cycling. You know what's a real move, and you know what's not a real move. You know,
yeah.
When, you know, so she, you know, and that was the thing. And I mean, she executed that perfectly. Like she, you know, she just tucked in there, and I'm just watching. And I remember, you know, I was at the start of the race, and you watch them go off, and then they take the, you know, agents and coaches
right.
and managers who went to the start. You know, they bus you back into Boston. So. Basically watching the race on my phone or, you know, everyone on the bus of you
yeah.
know, all the agents on the phone. I actually got to the Fairmont Hotel, which is, you know, near the finish
sure.
of the race. It's about when the women were hitting about the 15-mile mark, you know, and I walk into the suite that they have with, you know, the TVs, and there's like a little brunch thing for, like I said, all the agents and coaches and stuff. And you know, and they're about 15-mile mark, and her agent, I walk in, and he's just smiling. He's like, she's running perfectly. And I could just tell, like, by, you know, watching her and watching her face, I'm like, but I also knew, I mean, they're running 5:30 pace, and I knew that 5:30s she could do all day long and then some.
Wow.
You know? So
wow.
I was like, she's got to be feeling very, very good right now. But where I start getting nervous is I was like, when the fireworks start going off, that's when you
yes.
mentally, you have to shift those gears.
Yeah.
And you probably noticed, I mean, it ended up happening later in the race, and I mean, I was just getting more and more nervous, but you know, I think it was around 22 or so, and that's when DeBaba, you know, they started throwing down about 5 flat miles.
Yes.
And but Carol, she was responding, not with ease, but responding to each of those attacks. And I'm like, you know, that's when I was like, okay, we've got a good race going. She's definitely feeling good today. And you talk about nerve wracking though. They get to the 40K mark, and that's when it was down to Debba and DeBaba and Carol.
Yeah.
And the guy comes into the suite that, you know, we're all in, and he says, I need the representatives for these three runners to come to the finish line. And I'm kind of like, okay, I want to be at the finish,
but I want to see what happens in the race.
I want to know what the hell's going
yeah,
on for the
yeah.
next 2 kilometers, you know?
Yeah.
So they shuttle us, you know, like madmen. They give us, like, these, you know, like super top secret, high security, you
yeah.
know, like credentials. And they run us over there, but we get to the starting line or the finish line, and there's, you know, the Boston Police Department, you know, and they're like, hey, you know, you can't get in here, you know. And we're like, no, no, no. And the BAA guy who we were with is like, you know, these are the winners, you know. We,
they're agents,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
And you know, and the cops are like, I don't care who you are, you know. And we, like, freak out, and they end up, like, opening up. The BAA guy goes around, and we kind of, like, jump through these gates and stuff. I'm surprised we didn't get arrested.
Oh, that's funny.
As I came around the corner, I mean, it's only 200 meters from, you know, where we were in that room to the mm-hmm. finish. As I came around the corner, I heard, you know, on the PA, the guy say, it's now down to Kenya versus Ethiopia. And I was like, good.
Okay, because the other two are Ethiopian, so
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. I was like,
there,
she's
yeah.
still in it. And I could see we're standing just beyond, you know, the finish line. And you could see the jumbotrons then. And the only view that I had was that front-on view, you know. And it's like shooting 400 meters down Boylston. So it just looked, you know, they were running side by side, and I'm like, I think she's winning. Wait, I don't think. I think she's not winning. You know, I think she's winning. And I didn't know until basically the moment that she crossed the finish line, when I actually, you know, saw her physically cross the line, that she won, you know. And, man, that was a heart-wrenching, like, you know, minute there. And the thing is that night I went back and, you know, we went to, like, you know, the elite athlete, like, party
right.
that they have in the evening, which was at Fenway Park this
yes.
year, which was really cool. But they, like, I watched that tape. I watched that last 2 kilometers, and I was like, I'm glad. I'm really glad
that
I
it.
Was not watching that
yeah.
last 2 kilometers, because I would have been out of my skin. Yeah.
Wow.
Because it was exciting. You know, it was a crazy, crazy race. So,
well,
yeah.
How excited was she to get her first, you know, that's her first major?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's over the moon. I mean, she's really, you know, it's funny because people always say, and, you know, we've already talked about this, you know, oh, it was a surprise. It was out of the blue. And, you know, to her, it wasn't.
No.
You know, to me, it wasn't. You know, like, you know, I kind of, you know, right when she crossed the finish line, you know, that's what I hugged her, and I, you know, and I said, you know, like, I'm very proud of you. You knew you could do this. I knew you can do this. You just won. And she, and, you know, she kind of the same thing, you know? I mean, you have to have that confidence of knowing that you, you know, you could have won. So, I mean, of course, she's, you know, she's really happy. But we also, kind of along those lines, you know, the next morning she got up and she's doing press stuff. And I went to her room early and to grab her to take her down to this breakfast thing. And I said, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? She's like, sure. And I said, you know, I said, I'm glad, you know, but you, that you've made it to this point. You know, spent a lot of hard work and everything. And I said, now the trick is staying here. And I said, now it gets harder. Now it gets tougher. Right. You know, training actually, you know, you can't let up and you cannot forget all the sacrifices you've made to get to this moment because it's easy to. You know, you think it's easy to win now. You know, and, you know, it's kind of the thing. You have to stay hungry. And she's like, no, she's like, I understand. And this is kind of funny because she's very good at resting. We could say that. Like, you know, when I say, hey, take 2 weeks off, she's like, okay. And she will take 2 weeks off and not do anything.
Wow.
She's like, I kind of want to go for a run, you know? I'm like, no, you can rest. But I mean, I think, you know, she is, she's already kind of chomping at the bit again.
Well, it's not like she, I mean, it was her third marathon win. So it's not like she hasn't been in the winner's circle before. She knows.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right.
So,
exactly.
And when those guys go to starting line, anybody can win those things without how deep the fields are. Is it as satisfying?
Yeah, people ask me, you know, do you think that she could have won? And I was like, absolutely. But it's kind of like the Ironman in that way, though, too, is me saying that, oh, she's absolutely going to win.
Yeah.
I mean, if I said that, I'd be a bad coach. Because
big time.
There's so many factors that, you know, that are involved in that race and everything, and it has to be a great day for you. And, you know, was she capable of winning?
Of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. Did I know she was going to win? No.
Right. You know? Well, all you know is she's healthy and she's got, you know, she's had some great racing leading in. Half marathon training was her speed was there. Is she fast? Has she done a long work? Has she done her core work? And is she healthy?
Right, exactly.
And if she doesn't have a nutrition meltdown or some sort.
You know, she towed the starting line. Happy, healthy, calm, you know, ready to go. And I mean, that's all you can ask for. And if you can get to the starting line in that shape, especially when you're training for, you know, a marathon of that level, like, you know, but more than half the battle's behind you. So, yeah.
Is coaching someone to a win as exciting as winning yourself?
Much more.
Really?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For me, I mean, I love being an athlete.
Yeah.
And it feels really great to win. But I can tell you that, like, having her, like, witnessing that, you know, cross the finish line, that, to me, is significantly more gratifying than any win that I've ever had.
Wow.
And it was funny because I was sitting down with friends the other night, and we were talking about that, and they were like, you know, why? Like, you know, like, explain that. And I was like, I can't explain it yet. You know? I mean, I felt that way for the past, you know, many years of working with athletes and, you know, and having them like this. But I still can't quite like pinpoint, you know, like what it is, like what is that like dynamic in me. But I guess the one thing that I do know, and I mean, like I said, I kind of retired from triathlon at a relatively early age, you know, I mean, but, is, you know, maybe, you know, coaching, I think coaching is, you know, more of who I am, more of my career path, because I do totally relate to that, you know, a lot more, and it makes me feel, you know, more relevant, I guess, by, you know, being a great coach than being a, you know, great athlete ever was. So,
well, and I think part of it is that you've sort of built a team, right? It's you and it's Caroline and it's, you know, you've got a team of people, and when your team wins, when she wins, it's like all the parts coming together, which is different than your racing.
Yeah. And the fun thing is when you win a race like that, you realize how big your team actually is. You know?
Right.
Yeah. You know, I'm start thinking, you know, this person's like, you know, congrats, you know, it's been a lot of work. And I'm like, oh yeah. And you've been a critical part of a lot of this work, you know, and then someone else says the same thing. I'm like, wow, you know, we've got a dozen people here, you know, who have got her to this point, you know, and it is a big team.
Well, and as you said, the toughest part is yet to come. Because now when she goes to the starting line, and you know what that's like, you become the marked person. You know, nobody's letting you sneak away, and nobody's letting you sit in. They're like, hey,
exactly.
Boston winner, why don't you get to the front and put your nose in the wind for a little bit?
Right, exactly. No, exactly. Exactly.
Love
yeah, yeah.
That.
But, you know, for me, I mean, you know, my goal now is, you know, I like, you know, obviously, I you know, I'd love to see, you know, other runners that I work with, you know, continue to excel and to get better. And, you know, I'd love to see Caro, you know, continue to run well. But I'd also love, you know, to continue to you know, be able to recruit and pull in other great athletes into the group, you know, and get them to that level too. And, you know, my dream would be, you know, just having that, you know, having a nice, you know, a nice, you know, handful or so of really great athletes that I can work with on a daily basis and, you know, and kind of, you know, get to that level. You know, I mean, it's like, I mean, that's like, you know, dream job.
Well, and now Caroline is, she has not gone to an Olympics yet, right?
No, she has not. She you know, she's raced one world championships in Daegu. And, yeah, no, and that certainly is a goal of hers.
Exactly.
And, you know, but it's kind of like, you know, what we were talking about earlier.
The Kenyan 8,000
exactly.
women.
Exactly, no,
run.
I mean,
yeah.
you've got to be, you basically have to be one of the top three runners in the world if you're going to make the Kenyan team. So, you know, she's got a lot of work, but, you know, consistency and, you know, continuing to race well will obviously, you know, increase her chances of making the team. And I know that is, you know, that's certainly a big goal of hers. And I mean, I hope that, you know, we can do it. And certainly racing and training will be geared around, you know, getting there. So, yeah.
Hey, one other quickie. I noticed that you worked with Ben Canute. That is a special young man. He could make the Olympic team.
Yeah, Ben, he's a great kid. He's so young.
Yes.
And he's such a mature kid. I always tell him, I'm like, dude, when I was 21, which he just turned 22 this winter while he was living at my house, actually, which he spent this winter here, which was a blast having him here. I was like, I did not have, like, near the maturity that he had.
Right.
And not that, I mean, he's 21 in a lot of ways, and he likes to do 21-year-old things. He likes to chase girls and, you know, all that stuff. But he's so mature, and his outlook on, you know, on the sport and on his career and on what he can do is really impressive. And, you know, the reason why he came to stay with me is I work, you know, directly with his actually main coach. And I coach his main coach, actually, which is kind of funny. And you know, this last year, Ben had a decent year, but and late in the year, he wasn't running well, and his coach said, you know, can you get on his run schedule again? And so I started working on his run schedule again, and then he started running well, and, you know, we kind of had a talk at the end of the season. He said, what's the best thing for my run? I said, come stay with me, and let's work on your run this winter. And we did, and he's so solid in the water.
Oh,
and
he's
an
so strong on the bike.
The bike.
No
yeah,
question.
You know, it was
eventually,
funny 'cause all the local cycling groups were like, you know, whoa, who is this kid?
Eventually, you know? He'll be 70.3 guy after the Olympics. He's
exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah, he will. But, you know, his run has improved, like, over this winter. It improved dramatically. You know, he went to, the whole game plan was to go and do basically, like, the Southern Hemisphere, you know, the early races, and that's what he did. He did Auckland, you know, he was top 10 there.
Yeah.
He had a great, for him, he had a fantastic run right around 32 flat. And now he's doing Yokohama here in a few weeks. And then, and his run confidence is better. And, like, the thing with him that I have to keep on reminding myself is that he is so young. He's 22 years old. And so he's going to develop even more. So I'm kind of excited to see, you know, what he can do over the next few years. But, I mean, you're kind of spot on. That kid right now at 22 years of age, if you threw him in a 70.3 race, he would be a threat. Because,
totally.
Like I said, he can swim with the best of them.
He'd be out with
Potts,
and he'd be out with Potts, and he'd ride with Keenlay, and then it'd be a matter
exactly.
of people trying to catch him on the run.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, he's got a great career in front of him, and I hope to be involved with, you know, his career, you know, and continue to be. And, in fact, when he comes back, after the Yokohama WTS race, he's taking a little bit of downtime and messing around with some friends, but then he's going to spend a good 2 months here getting ready for, you know, the later season big WTS races, one being Rio, of course, and then the other one being Chicago. So
that's great.
I'm kind of excited to have him back here and to kind of, you know, get some more good training into him and then send him off again to get some solid races in. But, yeah, I'm really looking forward to watching his career, and I do hope to, you know, still continue to be involved with it, which I'm sure I will. We're pretty close now. So, yeah.
Love it. Hey, Ryan, first of all, congrats on everything you're doing.
Thanks.
It's really interesting to look back, 15, 16 years and see where, making the Olympic team and moving on to Ironman and now what you're doing. It seems seamless now when you look back on it, but I'm sure there was it seems like it just sort of moved in a lot of different directions. And at the end of the day, you're meant to be a coach.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, for sure. It's funny because especially with Caroline, a lot of times my parents over the years, and I mean, they know all these athletes that I work with really well, and they're like, you spend so much time with your athletes, and they're like, when's it actually going to pay off? And I'm like, I'm not looking, ultimately for a payoff, but I can tell you that all of those hours, all of those track workouts, all of those, Sunday mornings when I'm out running with them or on my bike, the moment she crosses that finish line, boom,
worthwhile.
It's all worth it. Yeah. Every moment. Yeah.
You know what you would love is a friend of ours just came out with a documentary on Coach Bob Larson and Meb. It's called, it's called City Slickers Can't Stay With Me, but Coach Bob Larson sounds a lot like, your ideal of a coach. He's a very special guy.
It's funny cause I talked to him, post race in Boston and, he's just
the best.
Yeah, he's a classy dude. He's a really classy dude. I mean, obviously, I respect him a lot, and he's done great things with Meb. And I mean, it doesn't get much classier than Meb either. No. He's a phenomenal guy. So,
love it.
Yeah,
Ryan, thanks so much for taking so much time. Congrats on everything you're doing. It's been an honor to catch up with you.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I'm going to catch up with you too.
All right. Again, we are brought to you by RacePlace.com, RunCatalina.com. Check out all of our interviews on Babbittville on iTunes and Core Sports, the very best women's athletic wear. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.